Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Of course, it was a dramatic night in the Midlands. It was also a dramatic night in North London, although I don't think any of us expected anything other than Fulham's relegation. It's been inevitable, let's face it, for quite some time now. And I think most Fulham fans will probably say that they did not sit on Christmas and say, oh, maybe we're going to stay up. I think most Fulham fans had their Christmas dinner with the knowledge that the next one will be in the Championship. But where did it all go wrong? That's the question, really, that I think most people will rightly be asking. I was reading a statement from the owners earlier saying that they will have to ask themselves a lot of questions and have a lot of accountability. Well, that is first going to need them to sit down and work out what they got wrong. It's interesting, actually, if you read what Shad Khan has said. He said, last night's outcome made official what we didn't think would be possible in August and tried desperately to remedy and avoid as the season wore on. That's an interesting thing to say, because that suggests that they came up and said, well, we're definitely not getting relegated. That's not possible. And that is unrealistic. As a promoted side, the first thing you have to do is avoid relegation. That's your first task, is to get to that, they say, the magical 40-point mark and say, right, we've avoided relegation, now let's push on. And I think, and I said this last summer on this station, and I don't think I'm being wise after the fact, when I say that the players they recruited, the £100 million they spent, was not on players who were going to be interested in a relegation scrap. Jean-Michel Seri, or Jean-Michel Seri, or whatever you want to call him, he was linked with Barcelona. Now that was, I think, pretty remarkable and a little bit of an outlier. But he's not the kind of player who wanted to come to the Premier League and lose away to Huddersfield and think, all right, we've got to pick up points where we can. He wanted to be in the midfield. He wanted to be in the mid-pack of the Premier League, competing, maybe taking the odd chunk out of, you know, various people. Apparently he's allergic to the cold. I mean, all right, don't move to England. It's not warm here. At least move to Southampton. It's slightly further south, you see. You might actually get a little bit of warmth there. So I feel sorry for Fulham fans, because I don't think the club was running the right way last summer. The owners apologised, and their supporters have told Sky Sports exactly how much of a disaster this season has been.
The club has got it all wrong in terms of the recruitment, the ticket pricing, the matchday atmosphere. It's just been quite depressing as a fan, really.
It's been happening all season, so in some ways I'm disappointed, but we enjoyed last May, didn't we, at the playoff final. That was the most important thing.
And then that's it, isn't it? If you look back 12 months, I was looking at the exact day, the 3rd of April last year, Fulham beat Leeds 2-0 at Craven Cottage. I don't think Fulham would beat Leeds today at Craven Cottage or anywhere, frankly, the moon, because they're just not a good side compared to Leeds, who are obviously on that run at the moment. That victory 12 months ago stretched their unbeaten run to 18th. They were third in the Championship. They even a few weeks later edged into second, the automatic places. It was, and let's be frank, a fabulous run. And their progress, frankly, through the playoffs was pretty inevitable, I thought. But that form came out of nowhere. They had only won 4 of their opening 17 games, and then they started finding ways to win. And then they brought in Matt Target on loan, and they brought in, crucially, Alexander Mitrovic on loan, both in January, and it pushed them further on. It turned them into a proper competitive side. The confidence was sky high. They knew how to play with each other. Momentum was brilliant. The dressing room was buzzing. And then, back in the Premier League, they spent £100 million on a completely new group of players. Now, Steve Sidwell, of course, played for Fulham and a lot of other clubs, Reading, Chelsea. He was talking last night and he said, it's been a shambles. Signing 12 players would have been demoralising for the existing players. The squad needed strengthening, but not to that extent. That is a very interesting point, because if you are one of those players who dragged Fulham, and remember, Fulham started the season dreadfully. They were really poor. They were something like 15th, you know, a third of the way through the Championship season. If you think about those players who did the hard yards and went on that run and did the playoff final and everything that came with it, and then all of a sudden, the recruitment brings in a whole bunch of other players saying, well, you know, you were good enough at that level, but not this one. What on earth does that do to your self-belief? What does it do to your confidence that the club believes in you? It honestly, it must absolutely shred it. You know, imagine that they spent nearly £50 million on Seri and Andre Frank Zambo Anguissa. I mean, that have they performed like a £50 million midfield pairing? No, obviously. They've been abysmal. So when they come in, and then all of a sudden they get bogged down, they lose away to Cardiff and Huddersfield in consecutive away games, obviously their relegation rivals, even if Fulham didn't believe it were possible they could get relegated, the players seem to lose faith in the project. By mid-November, they had one win, Slavisa Kanovic got the sack. That's never a good look, is it? When you've already tried to oust your players who, you know, had got you into the Premier League with new blood, and then you oust the manager who got you there and replace him with new blood, it says a lot about what you think of the group of people who got you into the Premier League. The rest, as I say, is history. The confidence had vanished well before Christmas, I reckon, among the fans. The players seem to go as well. They just drifted from game to game, defeat to defeat. And anyone who watched Scott Parker's press conference, even before they were beaten by Watford, knows that that dressing room was probably as low as any of its kind. He wouldn't even talk about bouncing back from the Championship straight away, which is what you're supposed to say when you're a doomed club. Say, oh, we're going to try and come straight back. But he wouldn't even really entertain the idea. However, there is good news for Fulham fans, and I didn't think I'd be saying that today. By popular, or at least what seems to be journalistic consensus, Alison Rudd and The Times leading the charge on this one, none of the players contracted to Fulham beyond this summer can leave at a discount. None of them have a release clause that we often talk about that would have been triggered by dropping back into the Championship. All the staff will see their wages slashed, sadly, but they've all got clauses that take their wages down again, just as they went up when they got promoted. Some of them by as much as 50%, remarkably. Some of those expensive-looking players like Sergio Rico, Callum Chambers, Luciano Vietto, Andre Schürrle, they all go back to their parent clubs. So that slashes the wage bill from £70 million to £20 million. Plus, of course, the parachute payment of £46 million and what usually comes out as about £95 million quid in Premier League prize money. So Fulham financially have not done badly, despite that £100 million spend. So they won't necessarily be in the Championship like, say, a QPR saddled with a massive wage bill. So they're probably going to be able to do things like hanging on to their players. Of course, we had Gordon Davis on the show, Fulham's all-time record top goalscorer yesterday, and he told us that he believes Tom Cairney and Alexander Mitrovic have both decided to stay. Now, remember what Mitrovic did in half a season in the Championship last year. I think he scored 12 goals in the second half of the season. Tom Cairney is a £25 million rated player by West Ham. Whether they can hang on to Ryan Sessegnon, I don't know. He's obviously younger. He's had Tottenham and Liverpool tracking him for a while. We'll see. But they've got the money to say to these players, look, we're going to invest more wisely. We've learnt our lessons. We've sacked our director of football, though that's obviously unlikely, with Tony Khan. I think Fulham should be vaguely optimistic that they can bounce back into the Premier League. And the key then will be that once you've done it and got it wrong once, you don't get it wrong again. Fulham can be once bitten and twice shy, but the first things first, they've got to get back into the Premier League at the first time of asking.
Love Sport.
Yes, we are just 24 hours away from the start of the Aintree Festival. Now, it will kick off at 1:45 tomorrow on Thursday with the Devonish Manifesto Novices Chase. But, of course, the race that everyone is talking about is the penultimate one of the week's racing. It's the Randox Health Grand National at 5:15 on Saturday afternoon. The ultimate pinstickers race. 40 horses in the field. Everyone has a bet. Everyone has a look. The office sweepstake gets very competitive and we see what we can do. One man who will be watching it extremely keenly is, of course, Gordon Elliott. He is set to have a record number of runners in the race. He, of course, saddled last year's winner, Tiger Roll, and it looks like there are 11 other entries coming out of the Gigginstown Stud with Gordon Elliott's name next to them. It has been a little controversial. Let's talk a bit to Oliver Brett, horse racing journalist, who's on the line now. Oliver, why is it so unusual for one trainer to have so many horses in, and why there are a few people a little bit upset about it?
Right. Well, yeah, let's tackle that issue straight away. It's unusual because there are literally, you know, hundreds of horse racing trainers around the country, and when you include Ireland as well, and So, you know, for one man to have what looks like being more than a quarter of the field is pretty extraordinary. I mean, he is a very successful trainer. He has the support of Michael O'Leary of Ryanair fame, so who sends him dozens of extremely good horses every year. So he's won the race twice as well. So he's allowed to put in as many horses as he can get qualified. So he's going to basically carry on doing that until somebody changes the rules and stops him from doing that.
Is there any chance that he could sort of? I mean, this is I'm just thinking on the spin, but could you, if you have, like, as you say, a quarter of the field, can you almost manipulate the race? Can he sit down with his various jockeys and say, this is how we want the race to fold out?
Yeah, I mean, you'd hope, it's a very good question. I mean, you could almost sort of employ two horses to sort of employ pincer manoeuvres.
Yeah, you could start boxing people in and things, yeah.
I know. And to be honest, that sort of thing happens more often in flat racing, where you kind of know what sort of, where you're trying to have a pace setter or something to guarantee a pace, and you might try and knock something else out of its comfort zone. In reality, it's very, very hard to know how a jumps race, especially one as unique as the Grand National, is going to sort of pan out. So you'd want to think that that's highly unlikely. It would be extremely undesirable if anything of that nature transpired.
Yes, it would be. I mean, it would be undesirable, but blooming impressive as well with a race like the Grand National. Why are people? Because I've read a few different columns, a lot of hand wringing going on. Why are people worried about it? Why are people upset about it?
I think it's simply because, and I noticed this trend actually emerging a couple of years ago, and I remember writing quite a detailed blog about it. There are lots of very small yards who have maybe literally 5, 6, or 7 horses in training. If they find one really good staying steeplechaser, they're desperate to enter it in the Grand National. It's such a big deal. Mm. Very often, the big trainers like Gordon Elliott will have so many horses entered that their horses haven't achieved enough to get into the race because it's such an oversubscribed race. Mm. So there'll be many that are many of these smaller yards that aren't getting their horses in. And I genuinely do think that is one of the negative things over the last few years, that the prize, because the prize money is so good, all the owners and all the big yards want to have their horses entered up.
Let's talk about the racing itself. Tiger Roll, of course, last year's winner, is Elliott's best chance, you would think. It looks like he's going to go off around a 7-2 favourite. Annabelle Fly in there, finished second in the Gold Cup as well.
Yep.
Is a bit of a pin sticker, the Grand National, but who have you got your eye on at the moment?
Well, Tiger Roll, as you say, is a definite favourite. A ridiculously short price. Just to explain to people, if you back a horse 7-2, and you back it each way, which is how most people like to do their national bets, you won't get a profit if it comes second, third or fourth. You'll actually lose money.
Yeah.
Because the odds are so short that once you quarter the half of the stake, you don't get anything back. Mm. So on the prices, Tiger Roll, who's got to carry, what is it, 5-6 pounds more than he carried last year. I can't see it. The horse I've had a little bit of money on is Lakeview Lad, who came third in a very tough handicap at Cheltenham. So staying on in the manner that suggests an extra mile would really suit. Maybe they've said there's a slight issue with the ground, but I've looked back at his form and I think he's done okay on good to soft ground. Important to mention, if it stays, it's been very dry in Liverpool. If it stays that way, they do quite often water the course. So it will never be rock hard and they won't be going too fast because that can create problems with the horses, you know, falling and things and because they're going too fast and then injuries, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there had been some worries about some vandalism to the track as well, but I think they've managed to deal with that too. There was also some talk, and one of these sort of classic tabloid stories that popped up, about Ronnie Wood having a horse in the Grand National, Sandy Mount Duke. Now, I understand a minor setback means it now won't run, but do you know anything about that horse and what sort of potential it's got in the future?
The trainer, Jessica Harrington, simply reported it was one of those just terrible bad luck stories. It's not a serious injury at all, but, you know, there's no point going going into races like the Grand National, we you know, with any sort of slight niggle, and I think that's what it is.
Mm.
And as you say, a great shame, because the public really open up to the race because of the stories of celebrity owners, and a little, you need a little bit of that. You don't need everything owned by Gordon Elliott's chief owner, Michael O'Leary, frankly.
Yes, well, quite. You don't want the same person picking up all the big checks on race day anyway.
Exactly.
Oliver, thank you so much for your expert opinion and a bit of insight into Aintree. That's Oliver Brett, horse racing journalist. Grand National, of course, remember, this Saturday, 5:15, you will be able to tune in to Love Sport Radio and get the latest results from the Aintree Festival. Producer Ben has ensured me that he'll be keeping a very keen eye on events from Aintree.
Love Sport.
Ollie's at the wheel of a bus that's just lost a hubcap. Of course, United came crashing back down to earth last night at the hands of Wolves as they came from behind to win 2-1 at Molineux. Guy Watts is our Post Sports reporter, but he's also our resident Surrey-born Manchester United fan, as they traditionally have to be. A very disappointing evening, wasn't it?
Deja vu all over again, though. I mean, crashing back down to earth, I think, happened really a few weeks ago when we were first beaten 2-1 at Molineux by Wolves. And this was a reminder, really, that we hadn't succeeded in getting very far away from earth again since then. You know, we've lost to Arsenal, we beat Watford unconvincingly at the weekend, so I was disappointed, but I wasn't that surprised by this result. This Wolves side have impressed me nearly every time I've watched them. It helps that most of the games they get on TV are against the big sides, and it's the big sides they've been most impressive against. But the biggest surprise to me has been that they've managed to not do better against the smaller teams, losing twice to Huddersfield being the most obvious example. Mm. There's no shame in losing to this Wolves side. They are extremely good, I think, in terms of their shape off the ball and their defensive organisation. I'd say they're right up there, you know, not in terms of being the best outside the top six, include the top six in that. They're a better defensive side than Arsenal, than Manchester United, I'd say, possibly Chelsea as well. They're a real side to contend with, and I think they could do even better than, say, 7th or 8th next season. But from a Man United point of view, it was a really, really damaging result. Even a point would have been something just to kind of keep the momentum going, whereas instead now we've stalled a little bit when it seems that Arsenal in particular are hitting their stride at the right time.
Yeah, you can talk about how good Wolves were so much, but it doesn't get away from the fact that United were poor. And I there was one point, I don't know what you thought, but for example, Paul Pogba, you know, this is a night when you're away from home, you're 2-1 down, you're down to 10 men. You need someone like a Pogba to stand up in the last 15 minutes.
Grab the game by the scruff, yeah.
And he absolutely didn't. He didn't look interested at any point.
I think that's a bit unfair. I think it was one of those games where if you've played, you can play at any level of football and have a game where everything you try to do is shut down, whether it's because your teammate doesn't quite, you know, isn't on the same wavelength as you, you get it wrong yourself, or, as was most often the case last night, the opposition essentially don't let you do what you're trying to do. And that's what Wolves did from probably about the 20th minute onwards. When did they get their equaliser? In the 25th minute. Yeah, they got a bit of luck to get that opening, but from there on in, they were the better side, absolutely no doubt about it. United started well, but by God, did we miss Marcus Rashford. And it's a tribute to how well he's played under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I know Pogba's had a lot of plaudits, but Marcus Rashford has been unquestionably our best player since the middle of December. And to lose him to an injury blow late on, it was a massive blow. And I thought we missed him massively. He and Pogba link up so well. They've so often created for each other. And I thought that Pogba, when he looked up, when he got on the ball, when he looked up, he didn't have the runs of Marcus Rashford, the dynamism and the drive to get in behind that Pogba feeds off. So many of Rashford's goals have come directly from Pogba assists this season, and in turn, Rashford set up a few of Pogba's. We missed him.
Well, I also thought that, you know, you're playing against a Wolves side who play 3-5-2. Everyone and his dog knows the system that they play. They basically pick the same players every week. What's the famous weakness of 3-5-2? It's down. It's width. It's vulnerable to pace out wide. And United didn't play any of that. They matched them up in terms of formation. They didn't pick, as you say, couldn't pick Rashford. Didn't pick Anthony Martial, who I thought was pretty effective when he came on, actually, and provided them something different. I don't want to say that Solskjaer is getting found out tactically, but he's got a lot of learning to do, hasn't he?
I guess he does have some learning to do, but that's a little bit inevitable, isn't it? He's a manager who's fairly inexperienced, and especially at this level. I think that he's shown in enough games already that he has tactical nous and ability, and certainly between him and his coaching staff, they have come up with extremely good tactical plans, whether it was in the victories away at any of Spurs, Arsenal, Chelsea in the league and the cup. you can't get it right every single time. You just can't. I mean, Man City got 100 points last year, but that was a record for good reason, because it is so difficult to have that many games where you are right on it in terms of both your own setup and nullifying the opposition. Solskjaer, he is still learning. You know, it's not a case of the wheels falling off or toys being thrown out the pram, but it's a little bit worrying just from this season's perspective, because obviously this is the worst moment in a season for things to start falling apart. The next game is against Barcelona.
Yeah, I was going to say, a small matter of Barca coming to Old Trafford in a week's time.
I don't really know where I stand on it. I can't wait. It's a huge game. It's in some ways the biggest game, you know, in the post-Sir Alex Ferguson era, because you know that a positive result could lead to something momentous. But on the other hand, I feel like it's probably the worst moment that we could be playing Barcelona in Solskjaer's reign so far. I think that at the back, we started to look a little bit shaky. Ashley Young, I could not believe when I read this was the first red card he's had in Manchester United colours.
That is remarkable.
I mean, this season, he's probably deserved four. At a conservative estimate.
And none of them are straight reds, all are second yellows.
He just fouls people so much, and he often gets booked in the first half and somehow clings on. I don't know if it helps that he's captain.
Is
and
it
maybe
referee management?
Yeah, there must be a bit of it, because his tackling is not well managed. His tackling is very poor.
Do you think he's like Paul Scholes, where he just has no self-awareness and he doesn't know that he's terrible at tackling?
I think he must. And the point is, I guess, that he is transformed himself so well in every other regard, positionally, you know, in a leadership way as well. Obviously, he's become essentially United's regular captain. He's transformed himself into a senior player who essentially can operate only as a left or a right back, when we knew him as a flying winger in his youth. That's mighty impressive, but sometimes if you can't tackle, you just never can, and
well,
that's proved the case.
Fortunately, before Barcelona come to Old Trafford, they've just had to go through a thrilling 4-all draw with Villarreal, scoring twice in stoppage time, and they've got to play Atletico Madrid on Saturday. Diego Simeone's side will do something to kick them, at least a little bit. United, meanwhile, have got 8 days off. I just wanted to quickly get your thoughts on the story that I'm sure you've seen from Jose Mourinho.
Yes.
About Paul Pogba basically refusing to get the bus back with the team and then getting chauffeur-driven in his brand new Rolls Royce. Jose Mourinho calling him His Excellency, yeah. Which did make me laugh. It's not the first time we've heard stories like this about Paul Pogba, but do you think this is Mourinho trying to rewrite history a little bit?
I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not. I suspect that there is some truth in it, as there often is with these things. Whether it happened in exactly that way after that precise game, I don't know. But it wouldn't really surprise me massively that Paul Pogba would have wanted to be chauffeured back to Manchester in his Rolls Royce as opposed to being on the team bus. Whether or not that tells you about what he's always like as a character, I can't imagine him doing it under Solskjaer. So I think it would be because he was already kind of at loggerheads a little bit with Jose Mourinho, and they were in this kind of very petty bit of one-upmanship, and one was trying to essentially establish themselves as the bigger man than the other, and Pogba was resorting to fairly petty things, and then Jose Mourinho would do what he could to try and stop him. But Mourinho sort of said to him, apparently, in Mourinho's version of events, that he could basically travel on the team bus a little bit of the way from Burnley to Manchester, but then he could get in his chauffeur-driven roles. But then when Mourinho came out of the press conference, there was the car waiting for him. I mean, look, it's the kind of nonsense that just wouldn't have happened, wouldn't have been possible 20, 30 years ago, possibly even when Jose Mourinho started off as a manager. And I guess maybe it's a little bit of an example of the sort of thing that the modern manager does have to be able to deal with in a way that keeps the player on side, and possibly that Mourinho isn't able to. Or it's just that Paul Pogba is a very, very difficult player to manage, and that even, say, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to end up finding that out to his detriment now he's full-time manager of Man United. If Pogba has a bad spell, or if he gets his head turned by a big money offer, or Mino Raiola gets in his ear, maybe we'll see exactly the same. We haven't seen enough of Pogba, certainly playing in England at Manchester United, to know for sure whether it was because of Jose Mourinho or because of Paul Pogba, if you see what I mean. And that's a little bit worrying from a United fan's perspective, especially when you see another disappointing performance like last night. It's not the first one we've seen in the last few weeks.
Love Sport.
Some big news coming out of South London. Now, you will have heard earlier this week that QPR sacked Steve McClaren after 11 games without a win. They were wallowing 17th in the Championship. They've yet to appoint a replacement. However, Lee Bowyer, we understand, has been linked with the job. There's various stories today that he would be receptive to talks, but that he has not been contacted, and Charlton have not been contacted either. Now, remember that Lee Bowyer does not have a contract at Charlton next year. That's his main problem at the moment, is he's realistically got a mortgage to pay, and he's like, well, sorry, lad, I haven't got a job next year. So if someone turns up and says, could you, you know, come and take our job, of course I'm going to say, yes, sure. Now, I know he's been in charge at Charlton since March last year. He's done very well. They're obviously pretty much shoo-ins for the playoffs at this point. It is possible that he will interview for that QPR job and that he will get it because he's a young up-and-coming manager. He's used to working on a tight budget at Charlton. He's going to have to do that at QPR. He's a good fit for the job. However, he will not want to walk away from a playoff team. For what he's done at Charlton, for how long he's spent there, he will not want to say, sorry lads, I'm off, when they're about to go into the playoffs. And remember, he might take his backroom staff with him. Johnny Jackson, Andy Marshall, they're both out of contract as well this summer. And again, maybe even more so, they're a slave to fortune. If QPR offer them a contract and Charlton don't, why should they say no? The honourable thing for Lee Bowyer to do at this point would be to say to QPR, look, I do like the idea, I'm interested in the job, but I can't come now. I've got to see Charlton through to the playoffs and through, hopefully, to the championship. And then I can say, sorry, lads, I've been offered a bigger job, you know, probably double the wages or something ridiculous, so I've got to go. That changes things. That to me, I think Charlton fans would have to say, yeah, all right, if you've got an opinion, Charlton fans, if you think Bowyer should turn down QPR no matter what, give us a ring, 0208 70 2558. But I have to say, and I will tell you this on the phone, that I think Lee Bowyer would be an idiot to say absolutely not to QPR. You have to listen to every option. Charlton could change owners tomorrow and they might not like Lee Bowyer. You know, so in terms of stability, you couldn't blame him for listening. The news story broke yesterday that Charlton were considering offering him a contract this week. I'm sure, in the light of these QPR links, that they will have been accelerated. But just remember the human value here, the human qualities that Lee Bowyer has, and the fact that he has mouths to feed, he's got roofs to maintain. It's important to remember that his current contract expires at the end of the season. And if you're offering him some stability, and I admit that it seems somewhat ironic, QPR offering someone some stability, but nevertheless, if that opportunity comes up, you have to take it. I really think you would have to. And remember that Charlton are by no means guaranteed to get through the playoffs. Portsmouth and Sunderland are both massive clubs with massive followings, and they're very, very good sides. It will be a struggle for Charlton to get through the playoffs. It's always hard anyway. But it will be especially hard given the teams that they will be up against.
Love Sport.
The occasion, much as it's important tonight, much as Spurs have waited so long to get into this state-of-the-art stadium, which is right up there in the Premier League now, it is almost as important that they get 3 points. Let's ask Jamie Brown of the Daily Hotspur and, of course, our own Spurs fan show every Thursday night from 7 o'clock, by the way. Jamie, just for starters, this must be like Christmas for you.
I'm very, very excited for tonight. Just going back to the area is very exciting.
Have you been back up there at all?
So I have actually. I went to the test event, so I was very fortunate enough to kind of get a look around. And it's just magnificent. It's kind of all the worries you have about, you know, will it lose its atmosphere from the old White Hart Lane and just different things. It kind of just put all that to rest and you just see what an amazing stadium it is.
This might sound like a really basic question, but I remember fans complaining. Obviously, Wembley was at times a real problem and games getting moved, tickets getting moved around. Have they been quite sensitive about keeping people together in the new stadium? Because I imagine if you're a season ticket holder, there's people sat around you, you've sat next to for 30 years. Presumably, they've had to try and map that onto the new stadium.
Yeah, so it's difficult to say from my perspective because this is actually my first year of being a season ticket holder. But I know that a lot of the main season ticket holders are all kind of in the wall, the south stand,
right.
That 17,000 tier, single tier. So that's obviously where we're hoping all the noise is going to come from. But I think that a lot that as I said, I think that they've tried to get the majority of the old season ticket holders in that section of the wall. And I really hope that they're going to create a really great noise tonight.
Are there any scars among the Tottenham fan base from this, what has been a delayed entry from all? Because I felt like the club drip-fed fans very little information and kept putting it off by a month. Is there any feeling of bitterness at the moment?
No. I mean, obviously there are some fans I know that are very disappointed that it has taken so long, that the communication has been disappointing. But I think we're all just very, very excited to get home tonight. In a way, I think we are disappointed with how it's been. I think that it's certainly affected our form in the league. I mean, we've lost so many, I think we've lost more games than we ever have under Pochettino. So I think it's kind of told in our form as well in the league. So that's been disappointing. But in terms of the communication, it has been poor this season. But having seen the stadium and what they've delivered us, I'm sure over the next couple of weeks, we're all going to completely forget about that.
Well, yeah, I think all will be forgotten and papered over, won't it? You mentioned the football there. It is quite important, actually, that Spurs win tonight. That they're the one of the most out-of-form teams in the Premier League. I think only Fulham have been worse. What do you put it down to? Because they have been dreadful lately.
I mean, if you look at two of our key players, Harry Kane and Dele Alli, I think they've just come back from long-term injuries. So it's been difficult trying to bed them in. Christian Eriksen, I think, is a very key one. Such a key player in making Spurs tick and just the whole style of we play. He's been bang out of form. And it's difficult to put your finger on what it is, whether it's his contract situation. I personally don't believe that's the case, whereas many fans do. So I think it's just a case of players being out of form at the moment. And certainly, I know it's been scrutinised quite a lot, but I think the lack of depth in the squad has started to tell. You know, on the weekend, we were kind of forced to put... it was Eriksen and Sissoko in the middle, and it's just really not very ideal. So I think the depth has also been tested, and I guess in a way that that's kind of... But a lot of pressure on the players to perform and to keep going week in, week out. And obviously that's going to cause fatigue. So I think that there's different areas in what's contributed to our form. But as you said, it's tonight's huge. Obviously one point in our last 15 is really not good enough. But we'll really be hoping that the new stadium can kind of help us hit the restart button.
You mentioned the Christian Eriksen contract situation there. It does slightly stagger me that these talks have been going on best part of 8 months now. Are you worried he's going to go?
I've multiple times on the Spurs fan show, I've said, yes, he will go, unfortunately. I think a lot of people say pay him whatever he wants. And yes, I agree with that. But it's not maybe if you offer him $300,000 a week, that's not what he wants. I think that that what he wants is a move to one of either Barcelona or Real Madrid. So, unfortunately, I think that that's what's going to happen. But
I can hear it paining you to say it.
Yeah, I tried to convince myself that that it will all be okay. But so I think one of the things I look at is the way Liverpool handled the Coutinho situation. I think that a lot of people are saying how such a huge blow for them. They obviously got in around, 135 million for him or so. They went out and signed Van Dijk and Alisson. So, in a way, they've become a better rounded team because of it. So, and there's certainly areas in our squad that need improving. And perhaps with the money we'd get from Eriksen, we could do the same in terms of improving areas that need strengthening.
Jamie, look, have a great time tonight. It's going to be very special indeed. That's Jamie Brown of the Daily Hotspur. And, of course, the Spurs fan show every Thursday night from 7 p.m. here on Love Sport Radio.
Love Sport.
Looking ahead to a night of Premier League action. Producer Ben will be making me do my Premier League predictions for tonight in a moment. But I just want to briefly talk about Manchester United because they were shocking last night, I think. Given that they had the game pretty much in the palm of their hands. Scott McTominay, by the way, scoring his first senior goal. Really nice strike as well. Helped a bit by the moisture on the surface. But even so, he got hold of it. It was a good effort. A nice goal. A good moment for him as well. Remember, he is, a proper United Academy product. There's not many of them kicking around these days. So good for the club and for the fans to have someone like him come through. But United let it slip. You know, they were poor. I wouldn't even call it a mix-up when Fred gave the ball away for the first Wolves goal. It was just poor. It was a poor touch, poor understanding what's going on. And it said to me, my God, United are going to miss Ander Herrera. Because they didn't have anything in the middle of the pitch. Wolves are a good side. They are a properly good side. But when you pick a midfield of Fred McTominay and Paul Pogba, you've got to expect one, if not two of those people to put a shift in. Fred didn't. I really think he didn't. Pogba was basically absent. After Wolves took the lead, 13 minutes from the end, Manchester United down to 10 men after Ashley Young got sent off. That's when you need your big players to stand up. And if Paul Pogba's not a big player, he calls himself the wrong baller for Mourinho to mess with. If he's not a big player, then I don't know who is. They were decent first 15, 20 minutes. Romelu Lukaku, it was a brilliant cross from Diogo Dalot, but Romelu Lukaku headed it straight at the goalkeeper. It was placed on his forehead and he should have scored and he didn't. So that, to me, would be a little bit worrying for United because they've now got 8 days and then they've got the small matter of the visit of Barcelona. Now, I don't think this 8-day break really favours them. I think they would be better off going straight into a game at the weekend, trying to get that performance out of their system and get ready for it. Because I really think they were that poor. Credit to Wolves, though, and I do want to talk about them because Nuno Espirito Santo's done a great job. You can say how much money their wage bill is or how much they've spent on players, but, you know, Fulham have shown that you can spend 100 million quid and still get it wrong. So you have to give the club some credit for that. If we're going to criticise Fulham for spending all that money and not doing well, you have to, on the flip side, credit where credit's due for what Wolves have done this season. And I think, unless Pep Guardiola wins the quadruple, Nuno Espirito Santo will surely be Premier League Manager of the Year, because it has been fabulous. It was interesting listening to him speak after the game. He said the result has shown how far Wolves have come.
I'm pleased with the performance and the way we really played. I'm pleased with that, I think. Of course, to do it twice with such a difficult and amazing team, it makes the effort and the work of the boys really, really good.
Yeah, it is worth pointing out, of course, that Wolves also knocked Man United out of the FA Cup, so have achieved an unusual double there, but a fabulous one. We had Jody Craddock on the show yesterday. You could hear in his voice, you know, a guy who spent 10 years at Wolves, played in three different divisions with them, more than 400 appearances. You could hear the pride in his voice at what they're achieving now. And that's, look, there aren't always good news stories in football. We spend a lot of time criticising clubs, but it's always important to come out and say, well done, where we can. And well done to them. It's also worth mentioning the Paul Pogba story that Jose Mourinho revealed. May or may not be true. It's Jose Mourinho. There's always spin involved. But I really do think it's worth mentioning. He was talking about a time he was asked by Paul Pogba whether he could get his chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce back to Manchester rather than go on the team bus. Mourinho said no. He asked him again, and he said, all right, we won today, so we leave the ground on the bus together, and 10 minutes in, you can get out and get in your car if you really have to. And then the car turned up to pick up Pogba anyway. That is not a man who plays for a team. It's not a man who obeys any discipline or any manager. It's a man who is only interested in playing for himself. And I'm sorry, but that's unacceptable in a team environment. If I was in that dressing with Paul Pogba, the man who said when he found out Mourinho had been sacked, shouted across the dressing room, he messed with the wrong baller, apparently. If I was in a dressing with that bloke, I would be saying it's him or me, Gaffer, because I'm not interested in working with this man. It's a team game, football. So many things are, sport or otherwise, and you need everyone pulling in the same direction, and he's not. And he showed it last night, by the way, because he was awful and absent. Speaking of people who were awful last night, my Premier League predictions, well, I didn't get any exact scores. I got one result, and I got the margin of victory, right? I said it would be 3-0 Watford, it was 4-1. So I'm going to have a crack at tonight's games, the first one being Chelsea versus Brighton. Not an easy one to pick, because Chelsea were so lacklustre at Cardiff. Now, I don't think Chelsea are in particularly bad form at the moment, because I'm sort of looking at it and thinking, well, they may have been poor, but they did win. You know, and it's two sides of a very similar coin. Say, oh, well, yeah, I know they got the result, but the performance was so poor. But to also say, well, champions, what champions do is play badly and still win. They still get the result, you know, when things are going badly. So I would be tempted to suggest that Chelsea actually aren't playing too poorly tonight. We're expecting to see Callum Hudson-Odoi make his first ever Premier League start just after his first England. That's bizarre, isn't it? So I actually think you might not enjoy it. Producer Ben, a Chelsea fan, might not enjoy the way they do it, but I think Chelsea are going to win 2-0, frankly. I really think they will absolutely cruise past Brighton. Chris Hootenside will be well organised, but I don't think they've got a huge amount Callum Hudson-Odoi. Maybe Callum Hudson-Odoi will get a goal. That's not my prediction. I'm just saying it might happen. And then tomorrow, when it does happen, I'll replay that bit and I'll sound like a genius. Let's move on to Manchester City versus Cardiff. 8-0, 9-0, 10-0. Honestly, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. Warnock, you feel a bit sorry for them, really. It doesn't really feel like they should be playing in the same league. Fortunately, next year they won't be. Just whisper it, because honestly, it might actually happen. Cardiff are going down. Don't tell Neil Warnock. He might kill me. I don't know. City will probably score a lot of goals. Sergio Aguero is out. Fantasy football managers everywhere wringing their hands over that one. Neil Warnock says he's 40-1 in a two-horse race. I'd be wanting bigger odds on Cardiff. I think it'll be 5-0 City. Now, the final one. This is tricky, I think. Tottenham versus Crystal Palace. I am really torn because it's a massive occasion. And Tottenham, and I don't want to use the word, but you all know the word I'm referring to. They have a habit on really big occasions. Someone's waving a water bottle at me. It's not the word I was looking for, Ben. It's the adjective. The Spursy is the word. I won't beat around the bush. And I just start to get the feeling that they might be growing out of it. And I do think that. They've shown it on big nights before, this group of players, that they can grow out of those results. Is tonight one of them? I don't know. I'm going to go 1-0 Tottenham. I don't think it's going to be pretty. I don't think it's going to be easy. I do think it will be an intimidating atmosphere for both teams. Remember Franny Benali, the Southampton player, saying that playing in a new stadium, it was like playing two consecutive away games because it didn't feel right. So, yeah, 1-1 Tottenham Palace. No, 1-0, sorry, Tottenham Palace. I almost changed my mind there. You know what? You can edit that, right? You can edit it tomorrow, and then should I say all the score lines? 1-0, 2-0, 3-0, 1-0, and then you can just pick the one that's right. We're live. Live? Oh, for goodness. You've got to tell me if we're live, Ben. You have to tell me.
Love Sport.
Manchester United's shock defeat at Wolves last night has left the door wide open in the race for the top four. Chelsea could go fourth tonight if they beat Brighton at Stamford Bridge. But will that alleviate the growing pressure on Maurizio Sarri? Let's ask former Chelsea defender Gary Chivers. Gary, are you surprised when Chelsea win away from home and the fans still seem to boo the manager?
Well, there's one thing you have to say. I mean, in the end, it was a decent result, but it wasn't a great performance by the Chelsea side. And to be quite honest, when you look at the game, we were quite fortunate at times, and definitely fortunate enough to get a win there, which at times looked like we were struggling.
As I say, United losing last night leaves things wide open. I'm sure there'll be a lot more twists and turns as the season goes on, but Chelsea are likely to finish with a similar, if not slightly better, points total than last season. They could still finish in the top four and qualify for the Champions League. The fans would have to be happy with that, wouldn't they?
Well, you'd like to think they'd be happy with it, but it's the way we're sort of like playing at the moment. We sort of like playing fits and starts. One game or one half, we look quite good, and then the next half, we don't look so good. And it's the movement of the ball, you know. I think with a lot of the fans is that we don't move the ball quick enough. But listen, it was a great result against a Cardiff side who were battling to stay in the league, and another good game tonight.
We understand from Maurizio Sarri, at least, that Callum Hudson-Odoi is likely to make his first Premier League start just after his first England start. Funny way around to do that. But how excited are you to see him get the chance to show his skills from the start?
Well, he looks unbelievable when he plays or when he comes on. You know, he's quick, he's hungry, he wants the ball. And one thing he will do straight away, Hudson-Odoi, which I love about him, his first touch is not back, his first touch is forward all the time. He's always looking to take the fullback on and whip some balls in, because we don't get enough crosses in, I don't think.
With your defender's hat on, Gary, how would you deal with him? If you look at a young guy like Callum Hudson-Odoi, first Premier League start, would you probably, not to put too fine a point in it, let him know you're there early on?
I, I think he could do that when I was playing, and that was what is expected from you, and certainly I did that as well. But with him, you're looking at the shining side, perhaps, because he loves the ball on his right foot. But the only thing with him is his directness. I love his directness, you know. And he's not frightened. He's not frightened to have a go. And even when he goes on the left-hand side, he likes to cut in and have a go at the defenders. I mean, he's so brash the way he plays. It's exciting.
And presumably having a player like that in the side will help someone like Gonzalo Higuain. A little bit more direct, maybe. That'll suit him a bit more.
Well, the one thing he does do, he whips in balls. He whips in crosses. And he's a decent crosser of a ball. And as soon as you get someone gets it like that, Aguino knows exactly what he's going to do. He knows he's going to take the player on, knock it down the line, and whip it in. So it's up to him to get into that 6-yard box.
Of course, on the other side of the pitch tonight, it's still a massive game for Brighton. They're 5 points clear of the relegation zone in 15th, but they're by no means safe yet. What's your gut feeling about that side? Chris Hughton done enough to keep them up?
I think he's done a fantastic job, Chris. I think he's been there 4 years now, or 5 years, and he's really, really built the side. It's a decent side, but you don't want to be the side of 83, because in 1983 they got to the cup final and was relegated. Listen, he'd rather be staying in the Premiership. You know, that's what it's all about, is staying in the Premiership. Obviously, he's got the cup semi-final coming up, which will be a massive game against Manchester City. But do you know what? If he wanted to get a result out of the two games, it'd be tonight rather than Saturday. Although saying that, they've got Cardiff coming up in 2 weeks, which would be like another final. So, some tricky fixtures coming up for him.
We assume Chelsea are going to get a win tonight, and I think that will put them back in the favourite slot. I mean, the odds at the moment on top four are swinging all over the place. But if Chelsea do, say, get to the semi-finals or the final of the Europa League and not win it, and finish in the top four of the to get Champions League football, does that ensure Maurizio Sarri a bit of a stay of execution, no matter what the fans say?
Well, you'd like to think so. You know, it's all been about getting in the top four, possibly winning a cup or getting to the final of a cup, and that's what it's all been about for Maurizio Sarri. And you don't know what he's got, obviously, in his contract. That might be laid in his contract. I'm not too sure. I wouldn't have the dealings with that. But, you know, when you look at it, if you look at it like that, that would have been quite a good season for us. You know, from the outset, it's all about finishing in the top four. That's what it's all been about, finishing the top four and getting a Champions League spot. Well, if he does that, he succeeded.
Just finally, Gary, Tottenham move into their new stadium tonight. It looks fabulous, and obviously it's very exciting for Tottenham fans. Does it make you feel a little bit jealous with Chelsea having been talking for so long about that new stadium, but it doesn't seem to be coming?
Well, I've seen the plans for it, and it looks absolutely unbelievable. But listen, I love going to Stamford Bridge. Wasn't that going there? What a place that is to go and watch a football game. With the stands all close in, and The way it is there, it's a fantastic place to go and watch football. I'll be quite sad when they take it down, if they take it down.
But I just wonder, though, because as you say, Stamford Bridge is a smaller ground. It is tighter. Tottenham, similarly, White Hart Lane, not a dissimilar stadium. Is it a little bit of a sign that Tottenham are moving past Chelsea in terms of stature of club, that they are now into this big modern stadium, so are Arsenal, and yet Chelsea are still lagging behind a little bit?
Well, you call it lagging behind. I've got my Chelsea hat on here. I don't think they're lagging behind at all. And if you look at the league at the present moment in time, although Tottenham are slightly higher, they've lost more games than Chelsea. So I look at it like that. And during last season, where we probably got a couple of players, they didn't go into the transfer market at all. So, I beg to differ on that a bit, but I've got my Chelsea hat on, you see.
Good. Well, you're allowed to wear different hats, Gary. That's all right. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Gary Chivers, former Chelsea and Brighton defender. 133 appearances for Chelsea, 217 appearances for Brighton. It's the Gary Chivers derby tonight.
Love Sport.
I want to just touch back on this Juventus story. In case you've missed out on it or you've not heard it, basically, Juve beat Cagliari 2-0 away from home last night. That's not unusual. Fairly routine, actually. Juve are something like 20-odd points, 18 points clear at the top of Serie A. Leonardo Bonucci scored the early goal. Moise Keane scored a late one. And both of them would end up making headlines for all the wrong reasons, I'm afraid to say. Keane, who is black, was repeatedly targeted by monkey chants from the home supporters throughout the game. It's disgusting, it was ignorant, and for once the referee was taking some, albeit action that did not work. The Juve players had protested to the referee, led by their captain, Giorgio Chiellini, and he was in conversation with both managers, and an announcement was made to supporters in the stadium. But it didn't seem to make a difference. It continued. Keane scored the late goal and held his arms up as if to say, what do you want me to do? I'm going to keep playing football. And those chants are said to have intensified. Now, let's have a listen to what Paul Morton was saying on The Breakfast Show this morning.
You take Juventus. It's a 19-year-old boy, okay, who's been subject to racist abuse for 90-plus minutes, okay? He responds, and he's not aggressive. He just stands there. And he gets vilified. Yeah. He is the victim. And that's what's forgotten. His manager and his player. Do you know what? That's worse than actually the racist abuse. The response from his manager and his own teammate who know him and know that actually this is not an isolated case. He goes to every single stadium in Italy and will get racist abuse. Okay, it's not a one-off for this young kid. And for his manager and his own teammates to say that tells you, when we talk about the issues we have, these are experienced players. Bonucci is an experienced international. Allegri is an experienced manager. For them to say things like that is disgraceful.
He's absolutely right. That's Paul Mortimer there speaking on Love Sport's Breakfast Show. And it is a disgrace. Let me just tell you what Bonucci, the first goal scorer, one of the most experienced international defenders in the world, and Max Allegri similarly said. Bonucci said, Keane knows that when he scores a goal, he has to focus on celebrating with his teammates. He knows he could have done something differently too. We're professionals. We have to set the example and not provoke anyone. I think the blame is 50-50. Are you insane? You think that if we're going to apportion blame here, we're going to say, well, 50% to the people who were ridiculing him for looking like a monkey and 50% to him for holding up his arms and saying, what on earth are you doing? You're going to say that the bigots are only half responsible for this situation. I actually was blown away by it when I woke up to read it this morning because it left me pretty speechless. Raheem Sterling, by the way, who of course celebrated by pulling his ears out and imitating a monkey in front of the Montenegro fans after he scored, after screes of racist abuse there, he posted on his Instagram, he said, the blame is 50-50 and tagged Bonucci in the post. All you can do now is laugh. I applaud Raheem Sterling for that attitude. I think it's remarkable that he isn't quite so extremely angry. Bonucci, by the way, responded, say, regardless of everything, in any case, no to racism. That's not enough. It's not enough for you just to stand there and say no to racism. Because it doesn't paper over the fact that you have massively undermined the campaign to stamp racism out of football by blaming a player for reacting to racist abuse. And for reacting in a pretty non-violent way and a pretty understandable way that does not go anywhere near the level of abuse he was receiving. Now, how on earth can he, in all good faith, write on Instagram no to racism when he himself has victim-blamed a young lad who's been out there playing for one of the best teams in Italy. He's played for Italy as well, by the way. And yet fans, who will probably cheer him on when he scores for Italy, will stand on the terraces and shout at him because he's black. What year is it? How is it 2019 and this is happening? Now, what about the manager, Max Allegri? He's a guy who is very experienced in football. And he would have stood up for his player, Moise Keane. He said he shouldn't have celebrated in that manner. He's a young man and he has to learn. But certain things from the crowd also shouldn't be heard. So his first port of call is to criticise his young player for reacting to the racist abuse that he has received for the last 90 minutes. I'm not going to suggest that he gets racist abuse every week. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But any racist abuse is bad. And 90 minutes of it is particularly bad. And the fact that he, A, stayed on the pitch, B, scored a goal, and C, had a pretty mooted reaction to what actually happened. A pretty muted reaction. Now, they've been saying for a long time that Max Allegri's been having English lessons because he wants to move to the Premier League. And we do think that he will leave Juventus this summer, having achieved everything he wants to achieve. He was in the running for the Chelsea job, may yet be again. He was in the running for the Arsenal job. Now, Max, or Massimiliano, to give you a full Italian title. I'm not saying that England is the paradigm of race relations in football. Players have been abused here too, and recently, and it's happened, and I'm ashamed of it. But if Allegri wants to manage in England, I think he's going to need some lessons on race relations as well as on how to speak the English language. Because actually, if this is the kind of thing he's going to say, I'd much rather he was speaking Italian. Because this is completely out of order. Can you imagine if Gareth Southgate had come out and said, oh, well, yeah, it was bad what they were saying to Raheem, but, you know, he should just ignore it. You know, we all get abused. No! Racist abuse isn't tolerable. We understand the pantomime villainy that goes on at football. We understand that. And yes, some people overstep the line. But there are some lines you can never cross. And obviously race is one of them. I can't believe I'm even having to say this about one of the most experienced people in world football. You know what? Here's the answer. Max Allegri is probably going to be up for a big job in England soon. And if they've got any sense, they'll give him a job interview. The first three questions I'm going to ask him at any job interview are all going to be about what he thinks of black people playing football, what he thinks should be done about racism in football, and what he thinks about his players reacting in a non-violent, understandable way to absolutely relentless racist abuse. Max, if you've got a decent answer, tell me. If you haven't, you can stay in Italy because I don't want to see you in English football.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.